Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 127games.com.
Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 119, Henry Hyde. For all of you listeners, new and old, you are in for a treat today. As you might be able to tell by the title of the episode, I have a very special guest here. He's been on the show before. He is an accomplished author. He's a magazine editor, just an all-around incredible wargamer. And I am delighted to say that he agrees for some reason to take the time out to come on the show time and time again to spend a little bit of time chatting with me. For all of your benefit, I am, of course, talking about the one and only Mr. Henry Hyde. Henry, how are you?
I'm fine, Jonathan. And my goodness me, how on earth am I going to live up to that introduction? You've made me sound like a superstar coming out into the middle of a cheering stadium. Well, thanks for that. At least you haven't built me up too much. English listeners will note the hint of sarcasm there.
I was talking this week at work with some of the people I work with about what I would be doing over the weekend, and I mentioned how you would be coming on my show, and they don't really understand what a podcast is, so I always describe it as internet radio, and they kind of get that. Yeah. So I was saying, oh, this person is going to be coming on, and he's great. And so they were asking me about you, and I realized that the best way I could kind of describe you, and you're probably going to hate this, is that you are sort of a wargaming expert. And they looked at me like I had two heads, and then I explained that you write books about history and how intelligent you are and smart and funny. And, of course, since I work at a library, they said, do we own his stuff? And I said, no, but I think we should. So hopefully that will result in a sale or two of the Wargaming Compendium for our customers.
Oh, fantastic. I'll send your commission in the post, Jonathan. Fantastic. Being described as an expert in anything is dangerous territory, and I would have thought that being described as an expert in the field of wargaming is probably even more dangerous, because as you and I both know, it's such a diverse hobby that you may have a good grasp of you know, one or two or several aspects of the hobby, but then there are other things that you just have to put your hand up and say, I know virtually nothing about, you know, X, Y, or Z. When you think of all the different hundreds, I don't know, thousands of different rule sets that people use, the different scales of miniatures, you know, all the different genres, historical, fantasy, sci-fi, pulp. Anyone who claimed to be an expert in the whole thing, well, first of all, they'd be a liar, wouldn't they? I think the thing is that because I wrote the book, which some people very kindly are calling the Bible, the Wargaming Compendium. I suppose it gives that kind of impression that I know a lot about wargaming. I think the reality is that I know a little bit about quite a lot of things to do with the hobby. And there are certain areas where, you know, well, I've got a history degree. And so when it comes to certain periods of historical wargaming, yeah, you know, let's put it this way. I have as much expertise as anyone else. But I think, you know, that it would be extremely disingenuous to claim that I had more expertise than someone. Because, for example, in the book, as you know, there's a set of horse and musket era war games rules called Shot, Steel and Stone. And obviously, the fact that I was able to do that reflects the fact that the horse and musket period, let's say 1700 through to 1870, something like that, that's a period of history that I know quite a lot about. And within that, the kind of mid-18th century through to mid-19th century, I know quite a lot about. But I certainly don't know more about that period than just picking a name out of thin air here. Let's say Dave Brown, who wrote the General de Brigade rules. I would admit completely, I know a lot less than someone like Brigadier Charles Grant, whose father wrote the War Game back in 1970, and he himself is, you know, hugely steeped in the history of the 18th century. But it kind of, I think, some people, and particularly, I think it's quite a British thing that they think I'm just a bit of a know-it-all, really. But
I would never describe you in that way.
Well, no, that's because you're a sweethearted kind of fella. But I think the thing is that some people got the impression, oh, that Henry Hyde, you know, he thinks he knows everything. Well, no, the fact of the matter is, the reality is when you study something, the more reading and research you do, the more you realize just how much there is that you, not only that you don't know, but that you can never know. I mean, you're a librarian, Jonathan. Now, you know, let's say, I'm interested in English literature. There's a different subject. So I go to the English literature section in your library, and there's all the famous novelists, you know, from Shakespeare, the Brontes, Thomas Hardy, Dickens, you know, going through and through up to the modern day. And you stand in front of those shelves of books and you look at them and you think, my God, I could spend the rest of my life trying to read all these books and I would never make it. And then you think of, and every single day that goes by, another 100,000, I don't know what the number is, books are being published, many of which may be of equal literary value to any of the ones on the shelves in front of me that are there already. So this is one of those things that you just have to say to yourself, okay, well, I'm just going to try and learn as much as I can about this particular thing and accept the fact, or you should accept the fact, that you can never know anything. You know, if anyone's so arrogant that they think they know everything there is to know about a particular subject, well, let's be kind and just say that I think they're misguided, Jonathan. So it's very kind of you to call me an expert, but I would say all I've been able to do with my book is kind of open the door to people. I've made them think about some areas of the hobby that perhaps they hadn't thought about very much before. I think some of the nicest comments I've had is from people who've been in the hobby a long time. And they said, well, you know, I got the book because I thought, oh, well, it'll probably be nice. You know, it probably won't tell me anything new. But in fact, they discovered something in there that either they'd forgotten that they knew, perhaps they knew it a long time ago but had forgotten it, so it kind of reminded them, or they found stuff and they thought, cool, blimey, actually, I didn't know that. Well, that's wonderful. That's the biggest compliment I could possibly have had. So there we are. So it's nice, as I say, it's nice of you to call me an expert, but I'm putting a big caveat on that, Jonathan.
Well, I think there are different degrees of expert. There are people who I would agree, I would not call an expert, but who would call themselves an expert on something. And they clearly are out of their league. Those know-it-alls don't know enough to know that they have many things they don't know. And I think that's a key difference. Really enlightened people realize that they not only don't know, but like you said, they can't ever know all that there would be about something. It's I will refer to them unkindly as a fool. To believe that they know everything or could possibly know everything.
Yeah.
But for someone such as yourself, who's had this tremendous history in the hobby, this wealth of experience, to be able to write a book like the Wargaming Compendium, that alone speaks volumes about you. I've looked for years for a more modern wargaming-inspired book, something that could give a glimpse into what wargaming is and would be accessible to the masses. There are other books out there that came out before yours, but none of them quite hit the mark. So when yours came out, and I still have not read all of it because it is quite a tome, over 500 pages of just page after page of insane amounts of knowledge. But when I came across it and looked at it, not only is it a gorgeous book to look at, beautiful to have on your shelf or on the coffee table or whatever, but it is worth its weight in gold to a wargamer because there's all these nuggets in there. It's very well referenced and written. It's a joy to read. And you don't often find nonfiction that flows as well and is as accessible and as enjoyable and informative all at the same time as the Wargaming Compendium. So I know, and I'm going to jump into this now because there's a part in the book that I was going to talk about later on in our chat, but since mm-hmm. it kind of segues now, in your book, you talk a little bit about the black powder controversy, and you make reference to the Wargaming Compendium in it, because when you discuss the controversy, for those who have not yet read that section, mm-hmm. you mention how there's this kind of schism between people who felt that Warlord Games and their rules, Black Powder, Hail Caesar, Pike and Shot, and so forth, felt that, well, one, how can any book cover such a vast time period? And also, why should anyone really spend so much money on a beautiful book that you only need a black and white stapled pamphlet or whatever? But I think there's value there. And maybe it's because I work in a library or because I love the smell of a new book. I don't know. The people look at me weird when I say that. But being able to lift something like this and hold it, you can feel the weight and you can see how beautiful the pages are and how nice the binding is. And being able to flip through and you could just choose a page at random and find something of interest and that inspiration, you're not going to get that in a black and white stapled whatever, whether it's for a black powder thing or something else. So I think there's not only wargaming value and all that, but there's also that aesthetic value. There's beauty there.
I mean, obviously something we've got in common, Jonathan, is that we're both bibliophiles, right? I mean, you must be a bibliophile because you work in a library, for goodness sake. You know, you can't be a librarian and hate books. To do that for a living, you've got to love books. And I'm someone, I love physical books and magazines. There's something about a printed document, a well-printed document, which is of value in itself, right? That's what you're saying, that beyond almost the content, a printed book has value in itself. And I completely agree with you. I mean, for example, I was in Lewes, which is the county town of East Sussex today. You've probably got many listeners over in the States who have no idea where Lewes is. Well, if you look at a map, of southern England and the county of East Sussex, which is right next to the English Channel, sort of the central south coast, there's a town of Lewes, which has got a castle in the middle of it. This is where Lewes is quite famous because it has a castle and there was a battle back in, don't ask me the date, 13 something or other, I think it was. I can't remember exactly. But anyway, Lewes is well known for having some absolutely amazing secondhand bookshops. Now, when most people think, secondhand books, what you mean, like remaindered books that they didn't manage to sell, so they're just selling them off cheap for a pound or two? No. We're talking about books like the one I've just picked up that I bought today, a book that was printed in, let me check it out, 1855. This is a first edition of Napier's English Battles and Sieges in the Peninsula, which is, I can tell you, quite a valuable little book. I'd heard about it. I'd never seen it in the flesh before. And this shop that I just happened to wander into by chance today and was looking along the shelves, as you do, and I said to the guy, have you got a military history section? He said, yes, only a small section just around the corner there. And I walked around the corner and there were, oh, my God, Jonathan, there were several hundred beautiful, amazing books, including this one, which has got like leather binding with kind of a gilt work on the spine and all that kind of stuff. You know the kind of thing I'm talking about. And it's got that lovely smell when you open it. And this is, you know, a book which it's just, there's no pictures in it. It's just black text on beautiful white pages with a kind of marbling around the edges and marbled end papers. But just the physical thing, you can tell that over the whatever, 100 and something years that this book is in existence, your imagination plays on, well, I wonder who's owned this book, who's picked it up, who's looked at it. There is actually an inscription on the fly sheet, and it was owned previously by, what's his name? It was Captain something or other. Yes, Captain John Murray. So it was owned by a soldier at some point in the distant past. How wonderful is that? So a book, yes, in and of itself, I'm one of those people who thinks that there is a value in a book almost kind of separately from the information that it conveys. But there are equally, and I accept this, people for whom the information is more important than the medium. Okay. And so when you're talking about like the black powder controversy, and it's not just black powder, because what this really revolves around is the whole, trend, if you like, for rule sets, not just to be sold as rule sets, but as glossy publications, be they hardback or softback. Black powder was just one of those kind of more obvious examples that where a kind of furore erupted amongst the historical wargaming community between those who, like you and I, think, well, regardless of the content, what a beautifully designed, written and presented work, you know, work of art, if you like, as a book in itself. Whereas there are other people who think, well, actually, all I'm interested in is the rules contained in the book. I'm not actually interested in the pretty pictures. Because if I want pretty pictures, they would say, I can go to an art gallery or a museum, or indeed, in this day and age, I can look on the internet. I can go to Google and type in Napoleonic War uniforms or something of that kind, or Battle of Waterloo, and I'm instantly presented with dozens, hundreds, usually, in fact, thousands of images of the kind that I want to see. I'm not really interested in, they would say, a particular manufacturer or a particular individual showing off their wares or their collection. I'm just interested in the actual content. I'm interested in the mechanics of how the rules work. I'm interested in how they've approached a morale system for the Napoleonic Wars, for example. And so that's kind of where the argument is. And of course, this also dates back to the days of, you know, when Games Workshop first came on the scene, Jonathan. I mean, as you know, before you took up historical wargaming, you were a Games Workshop kind of guy, weren't you?
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, you know, not necessarily unfortunately. I mean, there's no bad thing about it. But all I mean by that is that you would have already been used to the concept of, okay, that they don't present their sets of rules as, you know, a bunch of A4 sheets stapled together. They write, you know, beautifully illustrated, war games books, and not just the war games books, but the army books that go with them. So, you know, this is where it started, you know, orcs and goblins and the empire and, you know, all the different other things that you could buy Warhammer armies for, or 40K, you know, same thing, the Space Marines and the Tyranids and the other gribbly things, orcs with a K. They all had army books, so you'd have the core rule book and then the army books that supported those, that also brought in extra special rules and had painting guides for painting those particular armies and stuff. So that was very familiar, always familiar in the kind of fantasy sci-fi genre, certainly as far as it pertained to Games Workshop. But for historical gamers, this it was like the shock of the new, because it had always been, okay, well, you buy your rule set, and I've got on my shelf still sets of rules that I bought back in the, crikey, early 1970s, mid-1970s, where they are essentially just A4 booklets in black and white, maybe photocopied or, you know, printed very cheaply, usually with just a sort of a thin card cover, maybe the kind of a line drawing on it, something like that. And it is literally just the rules. And then if you want to find out how to paint your British Napoleonic infantryman, your French Napoleonic infantryman, your Austrian Napoleonic infantryman, whatever, you would go elsewhere to find that reference material. I mean, the most obvious and, you know, still famous example is the Osprey books. I mean, Osprey books in one form or another have been around for a very long time, certainly since the 1970s, before Osprey started doing their kind of men-at-arms books. It was much more difficult. I mean, there was a series by a company called, was it Altmark? I think it was Altmark Publications. But there were only a few. There were some sort of French and British Napoleonics, not very much else, as I recall, but they were sort of the precursors to the Osprey series. And then other than that, you really had to kind of hunt around and find really comparatively rare, quite big, and definitely very expensive hardback books, or you would have to find uniform plates, you know, done, made up from engravings done contemporary to the period you were talking about. It was really quite difficult. Certainly when I first started wargaming, back in the, well, what would have been for me the very late 1960s, early 1970s. There wasn't much about. In fact, there was a magazine, Jonathan, it's still in existence. I don't know if you've ever seen it, called Military Modeling. Have you ever seen it?
I think it's a derivation of it, International Military Modeler or something like that.
Oh, there's a number. The real old veteran one is called Military Modeling, and it's still going. Military modeling primarily dealt with was making model kits, you know, like obviously Airfix kits when they came out, but the bigger ones, 1/35th scale Tamiya kits, that kind of stuff, and plastic models of figurines. So things like there's a company called Hysterex, which I think is still going, a French company, which for a long time has created beautiful, absolutely exquisite 54mm size, mostly French, actually, Napoleonic figures. Their cavalry are just exquisite. So the need for uniform details, for example, came about largely not because of the wargaming fraternity, but because of the military modeling people. So they'd make their plastic kits, and there were obviously people that made kits in white metal as well, large scale, 54mm, 70mm, 90mm, and people would put them together, and then obviously they'd need to know, well, okay, what color should I paint this guy's jacket or bearskin cap or whatever. So that's what initially drove the need for kind of reference material for uniforms. And coming back to military modeling, what military modeling did was regularly they would have articles where people had gone into, you know, museums and found old books and stuff, and they'd researched the uniform details of, you know, a French Imperial Guard grenadier or a British Line infantryman or a Russian cuirassier, whatever it was. And they even ran a column, which was wonderful thinking about it. It was called Uniform Info. And you could literally write in. So let's say, you've been collecting some American War of Independence stuff, haven't you, Jonathan?
Yes, that's definitely my focus.
Right. So let's say you just bought a model of a Hessian grenadier, right? A classic American War of Independence sort of figure that you would get. And you couldn't find out what the front of his mitre cap should look like. You know, what colour should it be? Should it be brass? Should it be silver? What should it be? And is there some kind of engraved design on this? What did it look like? So you could write to Military Modelling and say, dear Military Modelling, I've just got this model of a Hessian grenadier. I've managed to work out that his jacket should be blue and the facings on the jacket should be red and the trousers should be white with stripes on or whatever. But I can't, from the old engraving I've got, which is faded badly, I can't tell what his grenadier cap should look like. And so they would find an expert. I mean, it might be someone who's just a more experienced modeler. It might be someone who's like a professor at a university, you know, or someone who's a professional illustrator who would then reply to your query with a drawing in the magazine, you know, a color illustration or something saying, oh yes, well, this should be silver, but for that regiment, it should be brass and da 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 da, and the little tuft on the top should be this color. And it was fantastic. And in those early days, I mean, people I know used to religiously, you know, even if they threw away the rest of the magazine, they would keep the uniform info pages. They'd cut them out and keep them in a folder or something because they were such precious reference material. I mean, this is how difficult it was. And it's only in later years when suddenly, you know, blimey, you can buy an Osprey book about everything. You know, people make jokes about it now, in underwear of the Third Reich or whatever it happens to be. You know, and you're laughing now, but probably, I haven't checked their latest list, there probably is a book on underwear of the Third Reich, you know, between May 1941 and September 1941. You know, Luftwaffe helmet straps of 1945. It's all available now. And what Osprey are doing nowadays is when you look at some of the early books, which were, let's say, British Infantry of the American War of Independence, for example, now you'll probably find they're doing, British Infantry just in the Saratoga campaign, because the Saratoga campaign's interesting because the, you know, some of the units there wore different headgear, you know, round hats as opposed to your typical tricorns and so on and so forth. So it's entirely possible that anything you can conceive of where you'd want really precise uniform details, Osprey, if they haven't already done it, by God, they're planning to do it. So, and in a sense, this is why I'm sure, just recently, Osprey, of course, have started moving into producing war games rules of their own, you know, with of gods and mortals and whatever you have, and the latest pirate rules and that kind of stuff, because even they're realizing, oh, I think we're running out of uniform books that we can do, guys. So as a publishing company, we need to diversify. So there we are. So that's how do we get there, Jonathan?
Well, we were talking about the black powder controversy.
That's it.
One of the things you were talking about made me wonder, do you think there's a difference of opinion based on generational issues? Would you say Grognards, for example, are more inclined to go to a book like an Osprey book for their supplemental stuff, whereas someone my age or younger is more likely to have grown up in the realm of, well, I want everything all together and I want it now. So they would want it all in like one book to cover everything.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things at play here. First of all, yes, I think to a certain extent that's absolutely true, that there is a generational difference where people of, you know, my age, I'm 53 now, and I've been gaming since, you know, 1969, 1970, around that sort of time. Properly gaming, proper gaming, as I would say, 1971, when I found the War Game, as I've told you before, and people are sick of hearing, Charles Grant's The War Game.
Great book.
Fantastic book. But the thing is that, here's another thing. That's a classic example, in fact. Charles Grant's The War Game, one of my favorite war games books of all time. All the photos inside are black and white, right? Mm-hmm. So the only clue you got to what color all those lovely marching regiments of his were, The only clue you got was on the front cover, where there happened to be a photo of a couple of regiments marching towards one another. All the other photographs, you were looking at them and thinking, oh, I wonder if that shade of grey means that they're green or if they're blue or red. I had no idea. This was one of the fascinating things. Years, many years later, when at the Partisan show in Newark, in what was it, 2007, 2008, I can't remember which year it was, that a group of us got together with Charles Stewart Grant and played the Battle of Mollwitz that had featured in that book, The War Game, back in 1971. We played a game on identical terrain using the actual figures that featured in the book. So these were Spencer Smith plastic miniatures that had been put together, painted and what have you back in the late 1960s. Okay. And so myself and the other guys playing, including, you know, Phil Olley, there's a name you would have heard of, Steve Gill, Stuart Asquith and others, as well as Charles himself. We put on this game and for the first kind of hour or so, we were just staring at the units as they came out of the boxes, because for all of us, it was, oh my God, I had no idea that that unit's coats were brown, for example. Oh, I had no idea their facings were blue. It's because it had all been in black and white. So, I mean, this is one of the other things, the limitations in the early days was, however good the books were by Charles Grant, Don Featherstone and others, almost all the photographs, and in the magazines as well, almost all the photographs were in black and white. So if you wanted uniform details, you had to find them elsewhere, because you couldn't just look at the pictures and go, oh, I'll paint like nowadays. You know, you pick up a copy of, you know, My Magazine, Miniature War Games or War Games Illustrated or War Games Soldiers Strategy. And you think, gosh, wow. Yeah. The American Civil War, or, you know, think of a war. The War of Jenkins's Ear looks really interesting. Oh, great. So I'll go out and buy those miniatures, and then I can use the articles in the magazine as a painting guide. Well, you couldn't do that in the early days. It was as simple as that. You had to go and find other uniform references. And this is why when Osprey books first appeared with those center sections with the color plates and all the descriptions of, you know, the uniforms, they'd gone into museums and pointed out, oh, right, well, the jacket was actually quite a dark red or a lighter blue, whatever. This was, oh my God, this was amazing information for us. Whereas nowadays, obviously, you can buy a copy of Black Powder, for example, and the book is, you know, every page has got color photographs on it, and you can use what's in a copy of Black Powder as your painting guide. You know, assuming that the guys who painted the miniatures that, you know, are in the photographs knew what they were doing, and to be fair, 99% of, you know, of skilled war games figure painters do know precisely what they're doing. You know, you can quite happily use those as the guide. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is that I think a lot of the older generation, the grognards, as you quite rightly called us, we kind of resent the fact that nowadays, you kids, you don't know how lucky you are. You get everything spoon-fed because, you know, it doesn't seem right to me. I had to really work at finding out what the color of a French Imperial Guard Grenadier's jacket was. I had to, you know, it took me a month before I was certain of the shade of blue. Whereas you just pick up a book and there's a picture of someone else's miniature in it and you just copy that, you lazy swine. So there is that kind of slight resentment, I think, that it was hard work for us, it should be hard work for you. But of course, that's a silly argument. It's just that, wow, you know, in a sense, you really don't know how lucky you are having all this stuff just, you know, given to you on a plate, where you can just buy a copy of Black Powder. And if you want, you don't have to go out and buy all those Osprey books, let alone all those other really expensive and obscure uniform books that cost you, you know, $50, $100 a time. You know, you don't have to do that. But there's also, I mean, this is where I think, there is a kind of a slight cultural clash and a misunderstanding, because there's also this aspect that because we had to work at finding out the information, it was also very educational. You actually, it's a bit like doing a, you know, a university degree where you have to learn to research. You had to learn how to make a judgment about, well, okay, I've got two different accounts here, two different, let's say there might be two different period engravings of a French Imperial Guard grenadier. Let's just keep to that as a simple example, right? And one of them, the blue of the uniform looks a lot lighter than the blue of the uniform in this other illustration. So if they're supposedly of exactly the same kind of type of troop, who should I believe? And this is where, you know, your intelligence starts to kick in. Okay, right. Okay, now let's look at this individual, this particular illustrator. Oh, right. Okay. So we find out a few biographical details about this guy, and we discover, oh, he actually went on campaign in Spain with the French army. So he was painting from life, right? Then you look at the other guy's biographical details and it says, oh, actually, he did these illustrations in 1840, let's say. Now, that's 25 years after the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And you discover, well, he wasn't ever actually there. He's done his illustration of this uniform just based on hearsay, on how he's heard other people describe what a French Imperial Guard grenadier's uniform was like. So out of those two people, who should I trust the most? Well, obviously the first guy, because he was an eyewitness. So if he saw with his own eyes that, you know, well, actually, after these uniforms had been out in the sun for a while, they did start to go a bit kind of pale and funny. Well, do you know what? I should probably trust his description more than this other guy's. So by doing the kind of uniform research we old boys used to do, it was really educational. It really was. And it had an effect, you know, I end up getting a history degree. And certainly I think back to, you know, the kind of research I did during the course of my history degree, having, you know, learnt things like how to weigh up historical evidence during my early teens because of doing things like uniform research and what have you, that was really, really useful. Whereas now, if you get, you know, Rick Priestley, it just so happens he's a very knowledgeable guy, and the guys working with him, you know, they were helped by the Perry twins, who are incredibly knowledgeable about uniforms and that kind of stuff. But the fact of the matter is, if you buy a book like Black Powder and you just paint your figures according to, or organize your regiments according to the what you're told to do by a particular rule set, you're placing a lot of trust on that individual who wrote that single book to have got it right. And there's a lot, I mean, there's more than that as well. There's a lot of historical war gamers understand, because of the reading they've done, let's say, you know, of the progression of the French army during the Napoleonic Wars, that a French army of 1798 during the French, you know, the French Revolution, and a French unit of 1805 and a French unit of 1812 during the retreat from Moscow and a French regiment during the Battle of Waterloo, they've all supposedly exactly the same kind of troops, but by goodness, they were actually very, very different. They were different because of the actual composition of the unit. So by 1815, they had only six companies per regiment, per battalion, whereas whereas at some point they'd had up to 9 companies. The number of men in each company has changed. What they were expected to do had changed. The level of training. I mean, when you look at the French army that marched into Russia at the beginning of 1812, was a magnificent military fighting machine. By the time of the Battle of Leipzig, let's say in 1813, after it had been through the terrible losses of the invasion of Russia, it was a very different kind of machine. I mean, they had a lot of kind of very raw recruits in the ranks, and, you know, that you wouldn't expect a French regiment of 1813 to put up with the same sort of punishment as a regiment from, I don't know, let's say 1809 would have done. And these are important things to someone who really cares about their history, right? Whereas someone coming to historical wargaming now, they might just say, I just want a generic French battalion against a generic British battalion and a generic French Dragoon regiment against a generic British Dragoon regiment. I just want it to look pretty and be fun. I don't really care that much about the history. And so that's where the crux, you know, the real crux of this argument erupts, Jonathan, is that people who really care about the history get quite upset when they're presented with something that's just sort of kind of, to their eyes, just a glossy kind of, it has the appearance of being historical wargaming, but actually it's not really terribly historical.
No, okay? It's not.
I mean, another rule set that you could look at, a black powder's, in fact, it's slightly unfair because they do go to the trouble in Rick Priestley in Black Powder, does go to the trouble of pointing out that, you know, in reality, there should be a difference between the units that you field for the French in, you know, this period compared to that period compared to that period. But there's other rules. Flames of War. There's another one, Jonathan.
Oh, don't get me started.
Right? Now, Flames of War is another, and we'll put this in inverted commas, historical rule set where people say, look, all I want is a game that looks great, has got, you know, loads of tanks and machine guns and armored, you know, lots of those wonderful STKFZ 251 German armored personnel carriers, and there's, you know, a ground attack aircraft support, and, you know, you get lots of shooting, and, you know, you get to get your toys out and have a game, and you can play a game in the space of a couple of hours and you've had fun. And fair enough, you know, and for some people, that's the hobby. There are other people who look at a Flames of War game and just put their head in their hands and want to weep because what they see is, you know, tanks wheel to wheel, you know, advancing as if they were heavy cavalry in an 18th century battle. And infantry doing much the same, you know, as if all infantry from all nations was sort of some of the kind of mad Russian hurrah battalions on the Eastern Front. When they know the reality of weapons from, you know, even the First World War onwards was that if you didn't want to die really quickly, you spread out. You take cover, you take advantage of every kind of bush and little fold in the ground to hide yourself from potentially deadly enemy fire, and also from high explosive that has a very wide blast radius. You know, the last thing you want to do if you're advancing your tanks or your infantry towards an enemy position is to bunch up so much that a single shell could wipe you all out. And there are many other rule sets that really encourage you and reward you for spreading out, for having what is known in modern parlance as the empty battlefield. Funnily enough, a couple of weeks ago, I was lucky enough to, there's a friend of mine in up in Essex called Steve Dix, and I was lucky enough to go out there and play a game of the Two Fat Lardies Chain of Command, which you've probably heard about.
I have. I'm actually going to be playing it, I think, in 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, there you go. Chain of Command, man. I mean, we also had the huge benefit that Rich Clark of Two Fat Lardies was there at the game with us, kind of walking us through it.
That's a big benefit.
Oh, yeah, that's a real benefit. Trust me, it's a huge benefit. He's a brilliant character. He's a really fabulous guy. Anyway, we played this game that was sort of set right at the end of World War II, 1945. So you got Russians advancing into Eastern Germany towards Berlin and moving through this, you know, semi-destroyed German town with Germans defending it. Some of the Germans were kind of hardened veterans and some of them were just what were called Volkssturm. So basically kind of like a citizen militia, with a couple of tanks. And, I and this other guy, Steve Clark, we were in command of, sort of a Russian, half a Russian battalion with some infantry and a couple of T-34s and an SU-120 kind of assault gun. Creeping our way gradually into this town, probing, trying to find out where the enemy were. And, you know, that I did have one platoon that made a rush across a garden to get into the back of a house. And I had them two bunched up and there were some Germans hidden in a factory just up ahead and they opened up with an MG-42 machine gun and virtually wiped out that entire section in one turn. Wow, that's a lesson in how, you know, with infantry, your tactics really need to be, you know, God, don't bunch up, don't do anything stupid, don't get impatient. And the fault I had made, you know, the mistake I'd made was I was getting impatient because it was proving really difficult to wink all these Germans out in this position. And I just thought, oh, sod it, go on, let's go for it. Let's get into the back of that building and chuck in some grenades and what have you. And I just completely, I mean, it's a real sort of Homer Simpson moment where I just completely left my flank open to enfilading machine gun fire and I paid the price. And it's a much more involved game. I mean, I think the thing is you're going to enjoy Chain of Command, Jonathan, because it needs some intelligence. You know, you actually need to be quite a thinking war gamer because it really puts you in the position of a junior commander. So whether you're a kind of sergeant or just a lieutenant, you know, commanding a platoon, and you're forced to think about what are the decisions I would really need to make if I was that guy right there on the ground, right there with those men under those circumstances. And you've got to think about kind of literally 10 seconds at a time. What are we going to do in the next 10 seconds? We're going to lob some grenades into that building, or we're going to charge into that room, or we're going to open up and give covering fire to this other platoon, you know. Bit by bit by bit. Whereas Flames of War is much more kind of generic. I mean, that's the only word for it, isn't it? It's generic. It gives the appearance of having, you know, flavor. And some people love it. You know, they like the fact that they provide you with all these organizational charts and this, that, and the other, and the painting guides and the different army books and the different theater books and what have you. But in many ways, as a war game, it's much more kind of generic World War II than something like Chain of Command. Where in Chain of Command, I mean, Rich and Nick have actually gone back to the training manuals. They've actually gone back and looked at, okay, how were the guys who commanded troops in World War II, how were they actually trained? And they've gone back to, you know, the archives and they found, you know, officers' training manual 1936 and, you know, updates, second editions in 1941 and that kind of stuff. So they're actually kind of getting inside the minds of the people who were giving the orders. So, whereas I think where something like Flames of War wins, if you like, is because again, there's someone like yourself, Jonathan. You were brought up with Games Workshop stuff. You were able to walk into a shop and you could buy your Space Marines, you could buy your Tyranids, you could buy your whatever else, your thing, Eldar and what have you. And there's the main rule book and there's the army books and, you know, other supporting material. So if you're used to that in a Games Workshop context, going into a different, you know, a hobby shop and finding, oh, there's a whole wall covered in Flames of War stuff. Oh, look, there's the rule book. There's the army books. There's the this. Even here's the dice and all the miniatures and the painting guides. That has worked very successfully for Battlefront because they've been able to take, you know, sci-fi fantasy gamers and almost say to them, well, we're the Games Workshop of historical wargaming. Right. And so as a commercial idea, that's been very successful for them for quite a long time. And, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that probably historical wargaming owes Battlefront a debt in bringing more, people from fantasy sci-fi gaming backgrounds into historical wargaming than might otherwise have been the case. But then you see, when someone like you, you're a good example, like you've arrived in a historical wargaming territory, Jonathan, and so you look around and initially you think, oh my God, now what do I do? Right? So something like a Flames of War or a Black Powder or whatever provides you with an easy entry point, comparatively speaking, into the hobby, because it's kind of like, well, it's a one-stop shop for you. And and then there's one kind of final point, I think, which is that much as those of us who, you know, oh, back in the day when I were a lad, I read the entire contents of Leon C. Library before I dared put, you know, a paintbrush on my first British infantryman. You know, that kind of attitude. Nowadays, the fact is people just don't have that much time on their hands, right? And whereas, I mean, I'm thinking when I was wargaming in my teens, I would happily spend entire weekends playing a big Napoleonic's game or Ancients game or 18th century game, and at leisure over weeks or months, you know, take my time researching the uniforms of, you know, the Prussian army of the Seven Years' War or whatever it might happen to be. Nowadays, people are under so much more time pressure. Because of the economy, the way our working lives are now, the pressure of having a family, you know, paying the mortgage and so on and so on and so forth. When it comes to our hobbies, for a lot of people, and I completely understand this, and at times I'm the same, you know, this, I'm not claiming to be, oh, you know, well, I'm still one of the people who does it properly. There are certain things where with me, I think that, gosh, if I can get something almost in a box, take it out of the box and start playing, man, that's a huge benefit to me. Cause I am such a busy boy. I'm a ludicrously busy boy. And time, sadly, nowadays, is the one thing I don't have a lot of. And, you know, whether, you know, you have to make a choice somewhere along that line as well to do with your income. Because for some people, you know, I know some people who are fortunate enough that money is no problem for them. So they can decide what it is they want to do, and then they can pay to have someone paint their miniatures for them. They can pay to have someone put them on bases for them. And so they literally, you know, a box arrives in the post, and they take a regiment out of the box and put it on the table and start playing with it. Well, that's fantastic. I wish I could afford to do that. I mean, for a long time, Jonathan, I was kind of very old fashioned in thinking, oh no, there's a certain pride. You know, if I'm playing with regiments on my table, I want to know that I'm the one who've painted them. And that's, you know, that's in my blood, because there really is something about playing with the miniatures that you have painted yourself, right? You invest them. You know, every painted regiment, as far as you're concerned, is a veteran regiment. But there's also been this thing over the years that, you know, let's be honest, guys, And we've all done it. We've played with figures that aren't painted. And it was always the thing that in your head, well, those regiments I have painted, they're the veteran regiments. They're the elite regiments. And the fact of the matter is often they were the first ones to run away. And it would be those really nasty, unpainted ones that you're a bit embarrassed about. They're the ones that hung on for grim death and fought off the enemy hordes, you know. Whilst your beautifully painted and based ones, they were the first ones to decide that discretion was the better part of valour. But, yeah, so for some people, you know, if you can afford it, why not? You know, because there's these painting services out in Sri Lanka and Bangladesh and places like that who will paint your miniatures to a very high standard for, you know, very reasonable money. And certainly if you're a professional person, like a self-employed person like me, where you have to think in terms of, okay, when I'm working, an hour of my time is worth, for example, let's say $50, right? Well, if it takes you 20 hours to paint a battalion of infantry, right, which isn't an unreasonable time, actually, that's pretty quick going. If it took you 20 hours to paint a battalion of infantry, that's $1,000 of your time, okay? So if a company in Sri Lanka will charge you, I don't know, $500 to paint that same battalion, effectively, you've just saved $500. Do you see what I mean?
That's the kind of math I like to use on my wife that she says is a little shoddy.
Well, yeah. Well, that's my theory and I'm sticking to it, Jonathan. But no, seriously, because the thing is, if you're a librarian, I don't know, I presume you're paid by your local government or the state or something. I don't know. Who's your employer, Jonathan?
Well, it's funny. It's changed over the years. I've worked at the same place. At first, I was paid by the state and then that altered, and then I was paid by private monies, and then I was paid by the local municipality.
Right.
I have to say, the community in which I work is one of the wealthiest communities in the entire Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Right.
And maybe because of that, I'm not sure, but as a coincidence with that, we're one of the lowest paid staff for our whole region of libraries. A lot of communities with a lot less money somehow find a way to pay more appropriate sums for their personnel.
Now, that there's a lesson in life in that, because that often happens as well. Something I can tell you, just a complete sort of like a little footnote here we've wandered off into. But with charitable giving as well, one of the things you find is often it's the poorest people who give the most to charity. Mm-hmm. Interesting, isn't it? But anyway.
Well, I think they're the ones who either benefited from it or have firsthand experience from seeing how much good it can do. Whereas people who have lots of money, they didn't get there by giving it all away to other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, coming back to the main text, this thing about painting your own units and that kind of stuff, it's for some people, it's a time saver and therefore actually a money saver, having units painted for them. For the rest of us, it's like, well, you know, as and when. But the fact is that I can see the benefit. I mean, there's a guy I know, I'm not going to use any names, who's creating a new army for himself. And he has his miniatures beautifully painted by a professional figure painter who's extraordinarily good at what they do. And he gets kind of a unit a month done. And, you know, I think, oh, crikey, I can imagine how much that's cost him. But I also have to say, and you know what? I wish I could afford to do that, because he's a really busy guy. He's got a very busy professional life and he works really hard. And that's kind of, you know, the main hobby he has. So why shouldn't he? You know, it's not like he goes out painting the town red, you know, getting drunk every night or anything like that kind. He's a very sober kind of guy and this is his passion and he wants to invest that part of his income in doing that. Why shouldn't he do that? And I envy him because I know I look at the thousands of unpainted miniatures that I've got and I've kind of, the older I've got and the busier I've got, because life is insane like that, I'm starting to work out and I'm never going to get them all painted in my lifetime. let alone if I was stupid enough to buy any more. So, I mean, the discipline of knowing when to stop collecting, that's another subject matter. But anyway, this the whole thing about, having an army in a box kind of thing to save time, well, why not? You know, and I know my friend Will Townsend, who runs the Plastic Soldier Company, who obviously makes brilliant kits for World War II stuff, and we're going to be we're going to be putting together some sort of a beginner's starter army set for him very soon. And there is potentially, you know, he could start thinking about, well, how about actually presenting a painted army in a box? So you get a set of the rules, you know, the battle group, whatever it is, battle group Curse, battle group Normandy, battle group thingamy rules. You get a company of infantry, you get a whole bunch of tanks, you get some artillery, you get the various commanders and what have you. So essentially you open the box and you're ready to go. And, you know, I know there'll be people go, that's terrible, you know, it's but why not? If it means that you can instantly get playing a war game, so long as you can pay the, I don't know, $100 or whatever it might be for that big box of stuff, at least it will save you so much time and so much hassle, and why not? But there are people who feel like in some way you're not a purist if you haven't painted those figures yourself. You're not a purist if you haven't built up a library of, you know, 1,000 books to research that period yourself. And in fact, in the last issue of my magazine, a huge argument erupted online because there's a guy called Andy Copestake who actually runs Old Glory Miniatures in the UK, wrote an article in my magazine along the lines of sort of army lists are rubbish, really. You should be doing your own research and not just believing that every time you trot out an army, it should have, you know, 6 units of infantry, 3 units of cavalry and a battery of artillery in this sort of generic way. You should do some thinking, because not only will you learn something, but it will make your games actually much more interesting. Well, this really annoyed some people. And a huge row erupted on the miniatures page on TMP, which rumbled on for a few days. And it just shows you that there are two sides of the fence, because there was this other guy came on and said, well, you know, who do you think you are to tell me that I should have to build up this big library? I haven't got the time. I haven't got the money to buy all these extra books and this, that, and the other. And, you know, there were some good points and bad points made. Certainly this day and age, you could turn around and say, well, actually, you don't need to go buy physical books anymore. Most of that information is actually available on the internet, and you can buy ebooks, you know, PDFs or ebooks of one kind or another that cost half the price of the hardback book or less. So you don't have to spend hundreds and hundreds of pounds. So, but it just shows you that there are diametrically opposed approaches to the hobby. And so when something like, you know, coming back to black powder, when something like black powder comes onto the market and says, look, basically, guys, here's Napoleonic wargaming in a book. All you need to do is go out and buy some miniatures. And probably because it was them featured in the book, you're going to go and buy Perry miniatures. And why not? They're lovely miniatures. And do what we've shown you in the book, and you can be wargaming very quickly. And what's wrong with that? But to some people, you just have to accept that they kind of – what if you were being nice about them, you would say they'd feel that if – in fact, and I would feel to a certain extent, you're kind of missing out. Because I think – I look back with great fondness to all the research that I did as a youngster, and I kind of feel like, oh, do you know what? It's a bit of a shame if you just buy a copy of Black Powder and – you base your entire knowledge of the horse and musket era on a single glossy rule book. You're missing out on so much. It's a real shame. But at the same time, if you want to get gaming quickly and you haven't got the time or the money or the resources to do anything else, well, that's fine. as well, you know, and the hobby is big enough to encompass both points of view. There you are. I'll shut up now, Jonathan.
Well, no, you raise some. You raise a lot of interesting points, and if I had five more hours, I would address all of them. No, but this is one of the reasons why I always love that you're willing to come on the show. Because, well, first of all, your time is precious and incredibly valuable, and for some reason, you agree to come on here when you could be doing much more important things. So I'm always humbled and grateful of that.
I'm talking about the hobby, Jonathan. So this, you know, it's for me, I'm enjoying it. So, you know, it's not a chore, mate. So don't worry about that.
But a while back, Sam Mustafa wrote an article. He actually did it in a competitor magazine to yours, in which he was talking.
You're allowed to say War Game Soldiers in Strategy. Hi, guys.
Although I love them dearly, this is the focus on you and all the work that you do. So I try not to advertise competing.
There
products.
You are. I've done it for you, John.
Okay. So he happened to do a column, which you may have read, where he kind of was trying to figure out what is the hobby, and he lamented that he seems to be like the only person in his circle of wargamers who still paints models. And anyone who's listened to the show for any period of time knows that although I love the look of painted models and I enjoy painting, I just don't have the time nor skill set to be able to consistently do it to a level unless I spend double or triple the time that anyone else does. So I was curious at one point, like, really, what do we define as our hobby of wargaming? So some would say I made the mistake, and some would say that I was being a little too brave. But I addressed the issue on a previous episode on the show, and I called the episode, "Are Painted Minis Essential to Miniatures Wargaming?" About 750 people so far have listened to the episode, and overwhelmingly, people seem to have decided that I was wrong, which is fine, because I love to hear back from people, whether they think I'm right or wrong or whatever. But by and large, people said that painted minis are essential. And I think there's actually one person gave me a very funny piece of feedback where they said that when it comes to not painting minis, they compared it to, quote, "It's like buying a train set and only laying out the track on the living room carpet." I think that's a great image to for here, because for me, I would have fun with the train set on the living room carpet. Is it ideal? No. But, I mean, I'm a kid at heart. So, like, when I flip through the Wargaming Compendium and you show some photographs of, like, how kids get into gaming early, playing with their toy soldiers on the kitchen table if they can wrangle it away from mom and dad for a little bit, or playing on your bed and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That simplistic, perhaps, approach appeals to me because, for me, wargaming is, it's about all sorts of things, but the focus for me is about having fun with the people you're with. And if that's painting, great. But for me, painting is a solitary experience.
Yes.
So the gaming and the camaraderie is there. So if that means taking unpainted minis and plopping them on a piece of cardboard and just going at it, I say do it.
Yeah, can I be controversial for a second?
Please do.
Painted miniatures are not necessary for wargaming.
I think we might get a little bit of listener feedback on that.
Do you want me to say that again? Painted miniatures are not necessary for wargaming. Okay, I'm going to give you a bit of history to back that up. Back in the very early kind of history of the hobby, let's go back to some of the kings and queens of Europe, Louis XIV, for example, had an army of miniatures cast for him by his father from solid silver. Do you think they painted them?
Of course not.
Nope. Do you think he used them? You bet he did. They were used, of course. Probably they wouldn't have said they were playing, but they were used to instruct the young king on military maneuvers and parade ground maneuvers and that kind of stuff. So they would move the pieces around, and there we go. So they were perfectly useful for what they were intended in their unpainted and beautiful state. Okay. And there are many other examples, I'm sure. Think of Kriegsspiel, played by the Prussian general staff. They were played, those games were generally played not with miniatures at all, but with things that really rather resemble board game counters. Okay. So the aesthetics of the game were secondary to the function of the game. What the problem usually is, Jonathan, is that what people don't do is, and this is where it's going to sound really poncy, they don't have a consistent aesthetic. Now, I think I've talked about this with Neil Shuck on View from the Veranda. Oh, gosh, how long ago would that be? A while ago. So the problem is often where you have beautifully painted miniatures on really crap terrain, it looks wrong. Or vice versa, you have really shoddy miniatures on beautiful terrain. It just doesn't look right. Your eye sees a disconnect between the level to which the models have been painted compared to the level to which the terrain has been constructed. As long as the two things are consistent, there's no problem. Your eye kind of visually accepts it as a cohesive design, right? Which is why, for example, model railway fanatics usually go to a great deal of trouble to put their beautiful and expensive locomotives and rolling stock on a beautifully sculpted terrain layout. Whereas people who buy sort of cheaper stuff are more than happy to have it going round and round on a piece of board. Okay. Putting my design hat on, everything has got to do with a consistent aesthetic. So I would be even more radical. If you're going to use unpainted troops, use the simplest possible terrain you can muster. Perhaps not even on a green board, right? There's a guy now, what's his name? I can't remember. Who makes wooden figures, wooden armies. And are they painted at all? I don't remember if they're painted at all, but they're certainly very, very simple, you know, like kiddie coloured in. And the terrain is the same. Look at, for example, H.G. Wells and Little Wars, where he was playing with literally toy soldiers. Mm-hmm. And the terrain he used was made up of piles of books, kiddies' toy bricks to make up buildings and that kind of stuff. You know, toy trees. Really, really simple, almost kind of comic book stuff to match the comic book soldiers that were marching around on it. So when you see a proper game of Little Wars laid out, and sometimes, as I've seen at shows, and I think there's a picture, at least one picture in my book of Little Wars style soldiers on a Persian rug, right? As if it's on a carpet in the living room carpet.
That's great.
And it looks fantastic because the style of the soldiers goes with the style of the terrain. If you were to put, Little Wars Britain style soldiers on a terrain made by, here's a name plucked from thin air, Dave Andrews, who does a lot of the terrain for Games Workshop. Absolutely amazing kind of museum quality terrain, sculpted terrain and buildings and trench systems, goodness knows what. The two of them put together would look utterly, utterly wrong. Here's another thing. My Spencer Smith soldiers, right? My lovely 30mm, mostly still plastic Spencer Smith. I've just done a blog post. You can point out to your list, your listeners, if they go to henrys-wargaming.co.uk, you will see a battle report of a game I played literally just a couple of days ago, with my Spencer Smiths marching around. They're all in this really simple marching position. The figures themselves, there's no detail on them. You can't make out the faces. They're just marching along with a musket over the shoulder. Any detail that's on those figures is because it's been painted on, because the figures themselves are so sort of crude, really. But you get loads of them together they look fantastic. And as long as they're on quite a simple terrain, you know, plain green table, you know, pretty plain hills, that kind of stuff, they look terrific. Now, on the other hand, if you were to take highly detailed Perry miniatures, and they're beautifully painted, and you put them on a really simple table, and I'm sitting here pointing at it now because there it is, they would look really strange. But I'm also with you in this other sense, Jonathan, that the bottom line for me is I am a war gamer, right? For me personally, getting to play games is something I crave. I don't get to do it often enough. So whether those figures are painted or not, so long as I'm playing with someone who is like-minded, then do you know what? I don't care. Because there's my friend Guy and I, you know, who I've known since university days. Oh my goodness me, we've had some fantastic battles where not a single figure on the table was painted. Did it matter? No. Did it matter that the game was games were terrific games? Yes, that's what mattered. Did it matter that I managed to spend some time having great fun with a really good friend of mine? Yes, that's what mattered. One of the things that has changed in recent years, Jonathan, is the internet. And I think that this is where the internet has had something of a negative effect, because what people tend to do, as I've just done, is you'll play a game and you'll take some pictures on your mobile phone and you'll post them on your blog. Now, obviously, when people look at pictures, pictures with prettily painted miniatures on pretty terrain are going to get much more favorable comments than pictures of a game where half or all the miniatures are unpainted. Because then it's almost like you've, in your enthusiasm, you've put a picture on your blog, obviously hoping that other people are going to like it and say nice things. You know, blogs are kind of vanity things. If we post something on a blog, we're hoping that someone's going to come along and say, oh, that looks fun. What you don't want is someone coming along going, do you know what? That looks really crap. So if, you know, like many things in life, Jonathan, if you're doing it in private between consenting adults, right? It's nobody else's business. And if you're having fun playing with unpainted miniatures, good on you, right?
I would hope someone, and maybe I have to be that someone, would have the courage to take some photos of their unpainted models, whether they're works in progress or, you know, permanent pieces, and share them online. Because I think if someone had that courage and made it clear that they were doing it on purpose and not just for whatever reason, I think people would respond maybe more favorably than we would expect.
Well, I think, Jonathan, well, I'm going to say this. I don't care whether people respond favorably or not. Why does it matter? I couldn't give two monkeys whether someone else approved of the fact that I was playing with unpainted miniatures. Who said it was their business? It's my miniatures. It's my money. It's my game. If I'm happy to play games like that with other consenting adults who are also happy to play games like that, why the hell shouldn't I? Right? It's a different thing completely. Let me say, if, for example, you go to a war games show, you would call it a war games convention. And you're walking around and yeah, there's people playing games. Oh, yes, there's some people demonstrating, you know, this lovely Napoleonic game here. And oh, there's some people demonstrating that World War II game over there. And then you turn around and there's a table that's really scruffy with a load of unpainted miniatures on it. Okay. Now that's where I do feel, do you know what, guys? You could have made a bit more effort. Right?
Yeah, but that's when you run away from that table as quickly as possible.
Well, yeah, because that's under those circumstances. Well, hang on. I've paid to get into this show, right? In the hope of getting inspired to see something maybe that I couldn't normally achieve. I go to a show to see something that's, oh, do you know what? I can see where, as a club working together, they've managed to achieve something and they're portraying something that would be really hard for me to do on my own. So I could stand around and talk to the guys who put on that game. So, oh, so how did you paint the miniatures like that? Or how did, oh, that's a really beautiful looking hill. How did you make that? Oh, that's a lovely house. You know, how did you make that house or paint the house? You know, that's kind of what you want when you see a game at a show, at a convention, because I can come back home and see crappily unpainted miniatures anytime I like, right? I've got thousands of them. I have been known to entirely carpet my war games table with rank upon rank upon rank of unpainted miniatures because, well, two things. First of all, it's a really good way of giving myself a slap upside the head to remind me how much painting I need to get done. But also, even when they're unpainted, I can appreciate miniatures as tiny sculptures. And this is the thing, you know, when someone, you know, sculpts a miniature, they're creating a tiny sculpture, right? If you were to go into a museum or out, I don't know, out on the streets, you live in Massachusetts, there must be all kinds of, you know, big statues of George Washington or whatever, you know, dotted about, right? And You wouldn't look up at them and think, oh, if only they'd painted it, right?
It's ludicrous.
A sculpture is a representation of a little human being, sometimes with an animal, usually a horse, you know, a camel or an elephant, something like that. And even unpainted, they are little tiny works of art, right? Yeah. And deserve to be appreciated as such. I mean, one of the things that is really interesting, I'm taking the Perry boys as a classic example of this. Alan and Michael Perry have on their website their kind of workbench section, and bits of it often appear on the miniatures page, where they show the sculptures that they're working on right now. So mixtures of some of it is kind of bits from previous metal castings, and then they've used green stuff to change the hat or put the arm in a different position or put a different backpack on. So this, and they're even in that state, so they're kind of cobbled together, unfinished, not yet even cast from a mold miniatures. They're amazing things because you look at those and think, God, I can, you know, someone's made that. Someone's put that tiny little face on that tiny little miniature. Someone's put that, you know, lace and buttons on that jacket, even though it's only kind of half a millimeter across. How do they do that? You know, that is one of those things about our hobby, you know, and the way that people can sculpt miniatures to this tiny scale that always blows me away. Right. And another guy I think of, Bill Thornhill, Musketeer Miniatures. He's someone I'm friends with on Facebook. He actually lives over in America now. He's a British guy, served with the Royal Tank Regiment, I believe, and is now living over in the States. He's married a beautiful American girl, and he is a figure sculptor. And on his blog and stuff and on Facebook and what have you, he posts as well, you know, sculptures that he's working on right now. He's been doing lots of sort of Dark Ages stuff and ancient stuff. And so actually when you get a pile of castings made from one of their sculptures, they are objects of beauty in and of themselves. And I would say ought to be appreciated in their, if you like, naked state. But obviously being war games, and we tend to be, you know, uniform freaks and that kind of stuff, for 99.9% of us, the bare casting is just a starting point. You know, you look at the casting and usually the most that one says about the bare naked casting is, oh, that's a nice casting, as in it's not covered in flash and bits of mold lines and, you know, it's all nicely crisply detailed and all the rest of it. And usually that's the biggest compliment we ever get to pay it. I would suggest, ladies and gentlemen listening to this podcast, that we should spend a little more time appreciating the work that has gone into that raw beautiful little sculpture that you're about to sort of smother with an undercoat and it will never look the same again. But, and playing with them. Yeah, as I say, you know, I think if you, so long as you have, why not, you know, kind of a bare brown wood table or something to go with it and really simple, just wooden block hills and stuff. Why not play with unpainted castings? Why not? Hey, it's a game.
Hear, hear.
There you are. Rant over.
As we get closer to the end of the episode, I actually have an announcement I want to make with you and with everyone. It actually sort of, in an odd way, fits in slightly with some of the stuff that we had been talking about not too long ago. I want to share with everyone that my wife and I are expecting our first child.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Congratulations, Jonathan.
Oh, thank you. The baby's due February of 2015, which either means, one, it'll be in perfect time for it to go to its first gaming convention, or the baby will come too close, in which case I will be missing Total Con for the first time in a while. But either way, it'll be good.
Congratulations.
Well,
wow.
Thank you.
All and really, to your wife, I mean, it's your wife who needs the congratulations, because she's the one who's got to carry the thing around for all these months.
Oh, I know. It's hard. The heat and everything, and she's so exhausted and all of that. It's not easy.
Fantastic.
I figure with all this talk about miniatures and things in their unaltered state, it's just a fitting time to make note of this.
A baby's going to pop out in this unaltered state. Wouldn't it be amazing if the baby comes out pre-painted?
That would be amazing. You never have to buy a stitch of clothing again. It's just, it's there.
Oh, dear, dear, dear. Amazing. Wow, great news.
Well, I figured, I thought of making the announcement on an episode after yours. Then I said, whenever you come on, people love to hear you. And I get, coincidentally, the highest listener numbers ever whenever you happen to come on. So this way, the news is bound to go wherever it needs to. I should say some listeners might be concerned that this means the death of the show. And that's not my intention. I'm not saying BB's coming and I'm done. There might be changes down the road.
Just you wait till the sleepless nights, my boy. Oh, just.
Well, I remember years ago talking with someone about Neil Shook's show and how there would be some episodes of Meeples and Miniatures when he would be whispering, he'd go, "So this is what we're doing." And I couldn't figure out why he would do that until the person explained, well, he had his young child in the room next door and he didn't want to wake him.
He's either got a young child or his wife, who's a nurse, I believe, and works night shifts. So he would have, for one reason or another, he's done a lot of whispering on the Meeples and Miniatures podcast. It's an ongoing situation. But, yeah. Oh, that's great news. Congratulations, Jonathan, mate.
Well, thank you. I think people have forgiven him and been understanding of his need to whisper. So if I have to down the road, I hope people will be okay with that as well. But.
Of course. Coming back to gaming then, Jonathan. So what are you really into at the moment, apart from unpainted miniatures?
Well, I'm doing, and this is all your fault, really, but I'm doing my own really tiny imagination campaign based off of ancient Rome. Just something I wanted to try. Since I don't get to paint models as much as I would like, I figured there had to be a way, besides me having hordes of unpainted stuff on a table, for me to play in a campaign. And I didn't want to bog anyone else down or rely on other people. So I figured I was going to do this solo. And what I discovered was that I could blend, not perfectly, but I could blend tabletop wargaming with my solo campaign and computer war games. So I'm using the Total War series of computer games. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gorgeous representations. They really allow you to get down to the nitty gritty. It's not perfect. There are some problems there and things don't translate as well, but with a kind game master, you can make allowances for just about anything.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. So are you actually collecting ancient Roman miniatures and stuff as well?
I am. I'm using 172nd hat industry models.
Yeah.
They are gorgeous and affordable. Unfortunately, I think they're either retooling their lines or they're going to reproduce them because they're out of stock just about everywhere. So I had to wait 6 or 9 months to get one box of Roman Legionaries, which was a problem.
Because I think another manufacturer that does lovely stuff is Zvezda. Zvezda make really nice all sorts of ancient stuff because I've got some of their ancient Persians and ancient Greeks, and they are beautiful figures.
They're gorgeous. I did look at some of those, and I consider them, except what's really pulling me in with the hat, I can get a box of like 30-odd models for $750 American.
Oh, right. Okay.
And the Zvezda, which worth every penny, I would say, but they're at least double the price for about the same number of models.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's a huge difference. So, yeah, that's understandable. So on the tabletop miniatures gaming front, would you be using something like Hail Caesar?
Yes. A friend of mine, and thankfully I'm blessed to have a group of war gamers nearby who are understanding and compromising with my foibles. They don't mind playing with unpainted stuff, and they're actually skilled painters. So usually get together and we'll put on an event at a war gaming convention or a show.
Yeah.
And we've really figured out who excels at what. So there's one individual who can scratch build anything for terrain. He's just amazing. So he handles all that. There's another individual who's just really good at dealing with painting, and he's fantastic at the organizational research to figure out how do we need to make a scenario work so that it's the most amount of fun for the players. And then I handle all of the PR and the networking with the people who organize the cons, make sure it's working well, and try to find some way to hype our game to make it stand out so that people who come, they will see all this other stuff, and they'll see models that will look better than ours, tables that'll be more appealing, but some sort of something that's going to grab you. So like 1 year we did Rev War, and I can't even remember what battle it was, but we did Rev War. And so I made up these orders.
I presume you mean what we British would call the American War of Independence.
Yes,
Rev
yes.
War.
So like at one point in the battle, there was like this trigger, and if something happened, then the British got to bring in a reinforcement brigade of Hessians, and if it didn't, then the Americans got to do something. So I had orders made up for like, this is what's going to happen, and if this happens, and this is going to happen with that, and I antiqued them and aged them and printed them out, and I rolled them up and had them in like twine, so they would look like they were, you know, would be really brought
scrolls
by a messenger, and like all that kind of stuff. And we try to add little things and do special signs. And one of my hopes down the road is we know people who are American War of Independence reenactors. They're redcoats. And so I keep on hoping that I can get them to come in uniform to one of these events and like stand near the table and stuff. And, just something to make us stand out. I have to say I'm also very lucky because we routinely do this at TotalCon, which is more of a role-playing game, sci-fi game convention here in Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they have a growing wealth of miniatures, and we are probably one of the few historical ones there, get a large crowd. We sell out every year.
Fantastic.
And a lot of that, of course, is due to the people who do the hard work with me. But the convention organizers, they're just amazing. They promote our stuff. They talk to all sorts of people, and they're very friendly. So over the years, I've gotten to befriend them and go behind the scenes to meet all sorts of individuals and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun. And then just kind of networking with people from Huzzah and Havoc and just all these other New England kind of conventions. Hope someday maybe we'll go to Carnage and all that sort of stuff. So it's a lot of fun to do that. I would say right now our focus after all these years still is playing Black Powder. I know there's a lot of people who are not fans of it, but it's easy. So we can do just about any conflict we want that we have models of, and we know how to play the rules, and we modify them a little bit for our own needs, and we're good to go.
And I've got to say, Black Powder, really popular, Jonathan. You know, I would say now, I mean, it's a few years down the line now, isn't it? I can't remember when Black Powder was first published, actually, but it was certainly a few years ago now. And I would say, certainly, the vast majority of historical war gamers are at the very least now aware of Black Powder. And to be honest, the people who were worried about what kind of games they might produce, either they've just played a few games and realized, do you know what? This is quite fun. It doesn't matter anyway. Or they've managed to come up with their own kind of house rules to tweak things that they're not particularly happy with, which is also great. And in fact, if I recall, Rick Priestley in the book says, look, you know, if there's anything you feel like you want to tweak, well, you go ahead and tweak it. After all, it's your game.
Absolutely.
So I think that's one of the really good things about Black Powder as a rule set is it isn't prescriptive. And, you know, that's what I would say about my own rules as well, my Shot, Steel and Stone rules in my book that now, you know, I've discovered, to my surprise, a number of people are actually using my rules, which is, gosh, that's flattering. But, if you know, and I would say the same thing if you find anything in my rules that, well, you know, I'm not sure of that. Well, change it. You know, it's your game. You know, I'm just providing a framework. But Black Powder, the huge benefit is that so many people have either at least heard of them or have played them now that you're quite likely to be able to get a game. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things about Warhammer, you know, in your old Games Workshop days. You knew you could travel to any major city, not just in the United States, but over here in the UK and most countries in Europe as well, and get a game of Warhammer, you know, either fantasy or 40K, even if you didn't understand the language that your opponent was talking, because at least both of you knew the same set of rules. And that's become true for Black Powder. Hail Caesar. I mean, gosh, Hail Caesar's actually become rather respectable. Have you heard of Slingshot, Jonathan?
I have, yes.
Slingshot, the Journal of the Society of Ancients, of which I am also a member, which is a very nice publication. And you will see in Slingshot there are people who have given game reports of games that have been played with Hail Caesar. Gosh, who would have thought Hail Caesar's become respectable? but, you know, and this is the other thing with Hail Caesar, Rick Priestley is a member of the Society of Ancients. You know, before he worked for Games Workshop and Foundry before that, Rick Priestley was an archaeologist by profession. Did you know that?
I can honestly say I did not, but that's impressive.
Well, there you go. You see, so there are lots of people who think, oh, Rick Priestley, he's that 40K guy. What does he know about history? Actually, mate, he knows an awful lot. And certainly when it comes to the ancient period, he knows a colossal amount. So, you know, he's been an archaeologist and a member of the Society of Ancients for a long, long time. So, you know, Hail Caesar, there's another rule set that people have gone, oh, poo-poo, it's all very gamey and all the rest of it. It's actually based on an awful lot of historical research. So, yeah, cool. Carry on. You were back at your convention. Sorry about that detail,
no,
John.
I actually think Hail Caesar plays better than Black Powder. I think there's a lot, if they looked at Hail Caesar and if that came out first and then Black Powder came out, I think Black Powder would be an even better game than what it already is. Granted, with anything with Ancients, you have to pay particular attention to hand-to-hand combat and that sort of stuff. But the hand-to-hand combat rules in Hail Caesar are just so well done that they kind of make Black Powder's hand-to-hand combat look a little shabby in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, gosh, that could be the subject of an entirely different podcast, the Ancients hand-to-hand combat rules. Yeah, obviously, in the pre-Gunpowder era, eras, the different kind of weapon and shield and armor combinations that are possible are extraordinary, and therefore you do have to pay. I think you're right that most sets of ancient rules either stand or fall on how well they portray hand-to-hand combat. And there are some rule sets where everything's over far too fast and others where, oh my God, it drags on for ages and ages. It's definitely a subject for me. I think we mentioned maybe last time I was on, well, it's a few years ago now. I used to be a member of the SCA.
Yes.
And so I got to do for real quite a lot of hand-to-hand combat. And it, you know, quite apart from most of the time thinking, oh my God, I'm too old for this. And, oh my God, I can't believe how hot it is in this armor. Please, when can I take this helmet off? Those are the first two things. But after that, it was always everyone you came up against. It was a different fight because, you know, you could have someone armed exactly the same as you are, sword and shield, let's say, but they're slightly taller than you, or they're slightly shorter from you, or they're left-handed as opposed to right-handed, or they've got a different shaped shield, or their sword is a slightly different length, or they're using a slightly different technique. It's wow. And you, the exciting thing in a sense was you had to kind of figure out in an instant how you were going to cope with this different individual coming against you, let alone if they didn't have a basic broadsword. Let's say they had a long sword, or they had a bastard sword, or they had a halberd, or they had a glaive, or they had a spear, or they had a pike, or, you know, my goodness me, two swords. And also, not just individually, but when you're fighting in a battle or in a melee, and you've got there's a whole line of you, and the way that just having a highly skilled individual in the right place in your line meant that in seconds you could tear apart your opponents. Or vice versa. If you found yourself with a bunch of kind of, your average middling guys, and there's a guy opposite who is really, you know, shit hot, knows what they're doing, then they could just take you apart in seconds. And then there's other times when you get two sort of fairly equal sides and the fighting just goes on and on and on, and you're almost, it sounds terrible, you're almost hoping to get killed so that you can have a rest. It's exhausting, absolutely exhausting. So when I see a set of kind of ancient stroke medieval rules, I'm always looking at, right, what's the hand-to-hand combat like? Can it have these extreme variables from, goodness me, it could be all over in seconds, to, God, blimey, this melee's gone on and backwards and forwards and back. Think of, you know, a lot of early warfare, you know, shield wall type warfare, ancient Greek warfare, where the ancient Greeks, for example, had this thing, a word you may be aware of, I think it's called ophismos, which is literally kind of like when a rugby scrum goes down. And they choose this moment to put on the big push as a unit and literally shove the enemy backwards by physical force. And that's what used to happen in a lot of hoplite warfare where, you know, they clash shields and they, you know, it's actually quite hard because you're pressed in amongst so many other guys. You can't wield your weapon properly to kind of stab and slash at your opponents who are behind these great big, you know, what were they, sort of 3 foot across, 3 foot diameter hoplon shields. And so you'd have to train, as the Spartans did or the Thebans did, to have this kind of signal would go up almost like 1, 2, 3, push, you know, and that would make a whole load of the opponents in the front rank kind of fall over backwards and then you're in, you know, and hacking and slashing and there we go. That's a whole different subject to discuss, Jonathan.
You know, it's really just a joy hearing you talk about all sorts of different topics. I know listeners enjoy it, but for me, it's a special treat.
Well, there you go. Perhaps I should do a solo podcast, and you can just listen to me droning on, Jonathan. It'll be good. If your little baby wants to get to sleep next year, you can just put me on. Drift off nicely.
I'm definitely hoping, no matter whether we have a boy or a girl, because we don't want to find out, but no matter what we have, I'm hoping I can slowly turn them into a little war gamer.
Yeah, that's what all wargaming dads hope for, but we'll see. Yeah, but anyway, so that's really interesting. Coming back to your campaign, your imagination sort of Roman campaign, I'm really pleased to hear that, Jonathan, and I think that's terrific. And, you know, when it comes to painting your miniatures as well, I mean, it's, first of all, if you're mainly doing solo wargaming, you haven't got to worry very much. And secondly, I'm sure you must have experimented with things like dips, haven't you?
Yeah.
You know, army painter sprays and dips and
the
stuff.
The quick shade is fantastic product. And I know someone who makes their own kind of like miracle sort of dip sort of thing. It's a it's a wash. Almost as good or maybe even better than the Quickshade stuff. And
well, using like the Johnson's floor wax stuff.
Yeah, kind of like that. It's a just a fantastic product. It's all he uses. He has three or is it four kids, I think. So he tries to find ways that are less expensive to accomplish some of his needs.
Oh, well, hey, yeah, of course. And also take less time. But there we are. You know, it's almost brought the conversation full circle, hasn't it? That, you know, and you're about to be a dad as well. Crikey. So finding the time for your hobby, you know, my philosophy is you do whatever's right for you as an individual that allows you to enjoy your hobby in whatever way makes you happy, and don't worry about anyone else because it's your hobby, not their hobby.
That's
there you go.
Really good advice I think everyone should take to heart.
There you go. Anyway, looking at the clock, Jonathan, we've racked up a couple of hours, haven't we?
We have. I think it's very easy to do.
It is.
So before I let you escape, how about you share with everyone how they can stay up to date on what you're working on, how they can connect to you, and the different products you have out that they can purchase?
Okay. Well, the simple way to follow what I'm up to, obviously I'm the editor of Miniature War Games with Battle Games, which comes out every month from Atlantic Publishers. So the website for Miniature War Games is miniaturewargames, all one word, .co.uk. And I also have a Facebook page for Miniature War Games, which is, what is it, Jonathan? Well, it's going to be facebook.com/miniaturewargames. That's the simple one. I have not one, but two Twitter accounts. In fact, I have three, but the two relevant for wargamers are, the identities at Battle Games. That's with the lowercase b. BATTLEGAMES at Battle Games, and also at Miniature WG. So that's at capital letter Miniature and then two capital letters WG. Because unfortunately, I think Miniature War Games had already been taken by someone else, and I can't remember who. Boo hiss. But anyway, at Miniature WG. But I tend to, if I tweet on one, I tend to sort of retweet from the other one as well. So you kind of find me. So those are the main ones sort of on a professional level. I also have my own personal blog. How do I do all this? Even reading out this list of all these things.
I have no idea how you find the time for half of this.
Well, I don't either, but there you go. There's some secrets behind the scenes, which I'll reveal to you in a second. But anyway, I also have my own personal wargaming blog, which is Henry's, without an apostrophe, obviously, because the internet doesn't let you have apostrophe. So Henry's-wargaming.co.uk. That's my personal wargaming blog, where you will see the post about the game I had just the other day with all those hundreds of Spencer Smith miniatures tramping around on the table. And then I have, of course, my book, which, bless your heart, Jonathan, you've been so good at helping to publicize for me, the book The Wargaming Compendium, which is, so it's not The Wargamers Compendium, it's not The Wargame Compendium, it's The Wargaming Compendium, which is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and through all good booksellers, is what I have to say. And, of course, through the publishers themselves, bless their hearts, must mention them, Pen and Sword, who've got their own website at penandsword.co.uk. Though I have to confess, of course, if you want a cheaper price, you'll get that cheaper price through Amazon, shockingly. And of course, the book is also available on Kindle and ebook now. So it's available, crikey, obviously via Amazon's Kindle and probably through the iTunes bookstore, I would imagine. But I've also seen it on Barnes and Noble and various other kind of online bookstores, that kind of stuff. So that's the Wargaming Compendium. And there's a website that goes with the book. So if you buy the book, you get access to some free goodies on the website, which is, surprise, surprise, the Wargaming Compendium, all one word, .com. The Wargaming Compendium. .com. So that's all that kind of stuff. And the next thing I'm working on, apart from the next issue, issue 377 of Miniature War Games, is I've been commissioned by Pen and Sword to write another book, another wargaming book. And this book is going to be Wargaming Campaigns. And those of you who've already got the book, the compendium, will know that obviously there was a chapter in the book, which I think I titled From Small to Large or something, didn't I, Jonathan? Which basically dealt with, it started right down with kind of one against one war games with kind of gladiators and went up through skirmish games. And I think I used, obviously Wild West Cowboys, that kind of stuff. And then up through big battles, which is where my Shot, Steel and Stone rules came in. And then I moved on to campaigns, talking about campaigns and included a set of campaign rules as well. Well, since I wrote that, I've been looking around at what other subjects I ought to cover, which kind of also meant, as far as I'm concerned, well, what subjects in wargaming haven't really been covered in depth for quite a long time. And the subject that kept coming up was how to run campaigns. So campaigns that can be as simple as bit like role playing, and let's face it, if you do role playing Dungeons and Dragons or anything of that kind, effectively, when you keep a character that moves from one dungeon to the next, one adventure to the next, that you're fighting a campaign. It's just that it's a campaign with a single individual figure or character or personality. And obviously, wargaming campaigns is just about kind of scaling that up. So you could have a campaign that, let's use the Wild West example. You've got a gang hanging out somewhere in, I don't know, Arizona or Wyoming, that's raiding banks and robbing trains and goodness knows what. And their campaign effectively is their career. You know, how long can they keep doing this until they get caught or killed by the sheriff and his posse, who are also effectively fighting a campaign to stop you from doing that. So that's one example. Bigger examples, I mean, quite obviously, Napoleon invading Russia in 1812, an enormous campaign to try and, you know, take Moscow and defeat the Russians, and then the Russians turn the table and kick him back out of Russia again, with a bit of help from their weather, which also happened later in World War II, of course. So those are huge examples of campaigns. Could be campaigns in space, in different planets, flying between the stars. It could be all sorts of things. I don't want to, you know, give too much away, but the book is going to be stuffed full of ideas for campaigns, mechanisms for running campaigns that can be fought with an umpire or a games master sort of moderating things, campaigns that could be fought without the need for an umpire, campaigns that could be fought just between, you know, you and a friend, as I used to do with my friend Guy, and coming up with ways that you can still manage to kind of surprise one another, even though you haven't got an umpire. Or it could be a group of guys at a club, a campaign that you might want to fight over many weeks or months, or a campaign that you might want to do in a single evening playing down the club. Campaigns that use dice, campaigns that use card-driven systems, campaigns that might use computers, campaigns that are done via email and the internet, campaigns that are done via the post, campaigns in all the different periods of history, sci-fi campaigns, fantasy campaigns, blah, 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 blah. So already, you know, if I think of all those ideas and I only gave those 10 pages each, it's quite a big book. I've sort of spoken to my publishers and they're a bit scared if the next book becomes as big as the Wargaming Compendium was, which was, what, 520 pages. And they're certainly very scared if it took me 4 years to do. So I've had to come to an agreement with them that no, it's not going to take anything like 4 years. But then that is what we said in the first place for the compendium as well. But no, it's probably going to take me, because they've asked me to design it as well, same as I did with the compendium, so that they look, you know, the same style. So I'm going to be designing it as well as writing it and taking all the pictures and what have you. The one thing you can say about the campaign book, there's probably going to be quite a lot of maps in it. That is the nature of campaigning, is that it has to do with, you know, territory and trying to capture territory and resources and that sort of stuff, and invading and repelling invaders and so forth. So there's going to be a lot of maps for me to do. But realistically, you know, it's going to take me certainly a year to 18 months. You know, I've got to be honest about this. It's probably going to take me about a year to write, 6 months to do all the design and stuff for. So it's probably going to be published kind of, where are we looking there? Early 2016, maybe the end of 2015. I don't know. That would be good if we could get it out in the shops for Christmas 2015. But again, it's going to be sent overseas to be printed. So I'll keep you posted, Jonathan. Let's leave it at that.
Okay? Whatever you do, don't put the cover photo on Amazon.
I've already said that. I've done a mock-up for them, okay, and I've plastered sample all over the front, so nobody's going to make the mistake of sticking it on some Amazon database somewhere. Man, don't remind me of that hell I went through for all that.
That was terrible.
God above. 3.5 years of people saying, oh, so when's the book out, Henry? When's the book out, Henry? I've seen the cover. I like the cover. When's the book out, Henry?
I remember having it on pre-order for a year and a half and wondered why it wasn't coming. Oh,
man.
Oh, Amazon.
Because I'm still writing it, guys. That's why. Anyway, there you go, Jonathan. So thank you very much for asking. I think that covers all the normal and legal ways, in any case, of contacting me.
Well, it sounds delightful. And I have to say, some people might wonder why they should bother connecting with someone on social media. Like, what's in it for them? Your content is always, it's something I wouldn't find out otherwise, or it's informative or just interesting. And there's quite a bit of, humorous things. You were the first way I happened to find out about the Weird Al video word crimes. So, you never know what you're going to find on Henry's social media, but it's worth it. And it doesn't cost you anything. So this like his true stuff, follow him on Twitter and all that kind of stuff. It's worth it.
Cool. There you go, Jonathan. Well, thanks very much for your time, Jonathan. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come on this episode of Wargaming Recon. I want to remind all listeners that, as usual, you can get all, well, not really all the content, but you can get what we talk about in the show notes, including links to Henry's enterprises and his stuff to purchase. If you remember nothing else, remember this web link, wargamingforums.com/WR119. That's wargamingforums.com/WR119. And that will connect you to everything, including how you can get in touch with me to leave me some feedback. I love hearing what you have to say. And as always, I try to share that in episodes of the show. And you will also be able to find out how to connect with me on Facebook, on Twitter, email, and all that sort of stuff through the notes on that web link. So until next time, we will keep on doing our usual stuff. The new episode will come out August 18th. And until then, as always, you know the deal. No matter how busy you get, no matter how many cover images you upload into Amazon, you have to find time to keep on gaming. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon and all of the other podcasts that you know and love. Or you can always stream and download the latest episode of Wargaming Recon by heading on over to the show notes for that episode.
Hey there, this is Ben Gerber from Troll in the Corner, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my podcast, Indie Talks. Indie Talks is a discussion about independent publishing, where we take a look at indie games, the people who write them, and the people who play them. We're going to branch a little farther afield as well and talk to some independent television and movie stars and creators, as well as crafters, all of who are related to gaming in some way, shape, or form. So please join me on the Troll in the Corner Network at trollitc.com and give Indie Talks a listen.
Geeks Explicitly. New episodes coming at you every Thursday, talking about geek life. If you don't listen to Geeks Explicitly, then only at trollitc.com.
This is Andreas, Apprentice of the White Order. I would like to invite you to listen to my letters, a humble collection of my observations of the various beautiful and very, very dangerous creatures that inhabit my world. I hope you enjoy it as part of the Monsters of the Shattered World on Troll in the Corner at trollitc.com.
Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network. Visit www.trollitc.com for more information. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 12-7-games.com.